Hi everyone, my name is Micah Utrecht, managing editor of Jacobin Magazine, and I'm also a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. And I'm glad you all showed up. You know, it's hard to make it to that first panel, even if it is like 10:30 in the morning, so this is the star students here. So I assume most people in the room know about the Democratic Socialists of America, the rise of DSA, or the rebirth, I should say, of DSA, after Bernie Sanders' campaign and Trump's election, the organization exploded from, what was it, 6,000, 8,000 to now over 60,000 members, I believe?
Close.
Well, no, it's close to 60. It's pushing 60. And has become a force on the American left. And so the purpose of this panel is not to weigh DSA, is it good or is it bad? Or, you know, ask sort of broad questions about DSA, although I assume some of the panelists will bring some of those broad questions about the nature of DSA up, but rather to hear from some people who are within organized caucuses or tendencies or non-caucus formations, or however they're, whatever they're referred to, within the organization, who are putting forward a political perspective within DSA. We should, I think, start by saying, I assume most of the panelists would agree, that the vast majority of those 60,000, almost 60,000 members are certainly not members of any tendency. And so all of the perspectives that will be put forward here are, in a sense, sort of minoritarian ones, in that majority of people who have joined don't subscribe to any particular ideological, is that yours? Okay. Oh, great. Thanks. Don't subscribe to any particular organized ideological tendency, so I think that's an important point to make first. I should also say that I'm not nonpartisan in general. I am a member of one of these tendencies, the Bread and Roses Caucus that's affiliated with the publication The Call. I am committed, though, to being a fair and balanced and neutral arbiter, because I do think that it is the best thing that can be done within an organization like DSA is to actually have real good faith debates about what the political priorities and what people's political perspectives should be. So we have here representing the different tendencies. First, to my left is Neil Meyer, who is an editor at The Call, which is the publication of the Bread and Roses Caucus, which was born on Thursday, right? Just the other day. Formerly the Spring Caucus, which maybe we'll talk about that. Next to him is Renee Parody, who is from the Socialist Majority Caucus. To the left is Tawny Tidwell from Build, and John Michael Colon from the Libertarian Socialist Caucus. And Miriam Benzman from the North Star Caucus is one who hopefully will, who's not here yet, but hopefully will show up. So because there's so many people up here, we're gonna do 7 minutes of people just giving the bare bones of what their tendency or formations thoughts are on strategy within DSA. We'll do some discussion between panelists, and then we'll turn it over to folks at the end for a question and comment period. So why don't we start at the end? John, do you mind starting?
Sure. Do you mind if I have my own timer here? So that I can...
Sure, yeah.
Okay, sorry. Okay, hi everybody. So my name is John Michael Cullen, and I'm representing the Libertarian Socialist Caucus. And to get started, I want you to imagine a room where a decision has to be made. And the people in that room, you know, have something that they've got to be doing that they're going to have to hold themselves to that decision. I would conjecture that there's basically two ways that the people in that room can come to that decision. There's one world in which somebody in the front of the room, or some group of people, have already made the decision somewhere else, and are merely presenting that decision in the front of the room and telling everybody else what they're going to be doing. And if those people don't comply with the decision that has previously been made, there's going to be some negative consequences for them, whether it's armed thugs beating them up, or them being evicted or fired, or whatever the mechanism of discipline is. There's another way that this room could be structured, which is that everyone is in a circle discussing and deliberating over the decision, and everybody who is affected by that decision has a say in the way that the decision gets done. The first room, I would argue, is the principle of authority, in which some people rule over others and have the ability to force them to do their will. Whereas the second one is the principle of neutrality or cooperation, in which everybody who is affected by a decision has a say in it, and therefore it is at the highest possible standard of democracy. Libertarian socialism, if you want to boil it down to a single principle, is trying to make every room like that second room. And to put it in more concrete terms, and this is from a dual power manifesto that the caucus that I'm part of put together, libertarian socialism is a system where the key infrastructure of society is owned in common, managed through direct democracy by the people themselves, and used to produce and allocate goods and services to each equitably and according to their needs. In broad terms, the power to make decisions in a socialist society should reside with those affected by them. Workers should run their workplaces and communities, their common affairs, with production and investment directed by and for all those involved. So just to clarify, libertarian socialism is not strictly anarchist. There's also council communists and autonomous Marxists and syndicalists and cooperative, worker cooperative people and things like that. But we're united by a generally anarchistic conception of socialism, which is basically what I described above. And the social democracy may or may not be part of the picture. There's disagreements within the caucus. There's people like me who think that a social democratic government would be an important component of any movement. And there's other people who are strictly against electoralism in the caucus. But the thing that unites everybody in it is the idea that regardless of whether there is a role for a social democratic type series of reforms, the core of a socialist strategy should be something called dual power, which we've defined in a very long manifesto, which you can find on our website, that was collectively written, as essentially a strategy that builds liberated spaces and institutions in civil society. So these are alternative poles of power outside the state, which are directly democratic, are created by and run by ordinary people, and put some kind of production or some kind of resources under the direct democratic control of workers in the here and now. This can be an anarcho-syndicalist trade union that is itself run as a confederation of assemblies and wants to turn workplaces into that too. It can be a workers' cooperative where things are already run that way. It can be neighborhood councils. It can be projects like neighborhood assemblies and mutual aid and disaster relief and tenants unions, community land trusts, community owned housing. The point is that it has to be structured as an assembly democracy internally. It has to put power directly in the hands of the people here and now. It can be used to win short-term gains, but it is also the germ of a socialist society, which once enough of these have been established and networked, actually can form a counterpower and a series of counter institutions to the state. And without these alternative poles of power, we would argue, any socialist movement would threaten either being smashed by the bourgeois state or co-opted by an authoritarian so-called socialist state. And that's basically our strategy for what DSA should be doing externally. As far as internally, we are very interested in a number of different reforms that would make DSA more internally democratic. And we have a sort of broader definition, a narrow one. Obviously, you've heard the narrow one. We believe in assembly democracy and direct democracy, which is things like assemblies, confederations with mandated and recallable delegates, and referenda. But obviously, not everybody shares the same idea of democracy. Nevertheless, I would argue that most of DSA does have a generally egalitarian and generally kind of flattening and anti-hierarchical conception of democracy, because part of the reason why we're in the DSA is because we think that society is insufficiently democratic and that's why it should be socialist. So the way that this basically gets sliced up in LSC is that we see ourselves as, and our particular conception of democracy is the most extreme form of democracy. But as long as people want to play ball with the idea, the broad idea, even if it's not as rigorous, let's say, as the direct democratic assembly of people who have a stake in decisions should be able to say to have a say in them, then we want to be able to play ball with them, and we want to be able to work in a movement that is made up of larger people with different points of view from us, because obviously if everybody has a stake in a decision that affects them, then that means that if you believe strongly about something, you should have the freedom to organize other people who believe in that same thing and advocate for your point of view.
I mean, 1 minute.
Thank you. So a lot of our reforms involve things like expanding the NPC, having a national with like regional representation and more democratic accountability structures, abolishing unelected bodies like the steering committee, which arguably have too much power for unelected bodies. You know, making the finances more transparent, greater chapter democracy, things like that, and that's all in another manifesto. And just a little bit about the caucus. LSC is actually the largest and oldest continually existing political caucus in the PSA. We have over 900 members in all but three states, with eight locals within or between DSA locals that are organizing hubs for libertarian socialists. And we, our members have either through the LSC or through their local chapters participated in activities like creating brake light clinics, participating and spearheading DSA's participation in the Occupy ICE occupations, which helped change the discourse last year surrounding Trump's immigration program, mutual aid disaster relief, particularly in the West Coast with the California fires, political education programs, initiatives to start co-ops like the New York City DSA Debt and Finance Working Group's credit union plan, which is in its early stages but is very ambitious, and open access sample bylaws and meeting procedures that tell people how to run things as assembly democracies, which they can just take and modify as they please, but helps people get started, even if they don't necessarily agree with us 100%. It gives them something to play with, and it's all available on our website, which is dsa-lsc.org.
Tawny.
Hi, my name is Tawny Tidwell. My pronouns are she, her, and I realized coming into the room just now that I should probably tell you that in addition to being an organizing project within DSA, Build also publishes a zine by the same name that talks about DSA's work nationally. We solicit pitches from all over the country, and if you want to talk more about that later, let me know. To start on my remarks for this panel, everything that I say today comes from my personal perspective as someone involved in the project, rather than as something definitive for everyone at Build. I know there are people on my team who would disagree with some and maybe a lot of what I'm gonna say today, but that's okay. After all, they decided that I should be the one that's up here. So, we're supposed to talk about what we believe are strategic priorities for DSA with political arguments to support those priorities. While Build doesn't really have issues-based priorities, much less a single set of politics, collectively, we believe that our diversity of viewpoints makes us stronger and that no specific tactics, whether they're direct action or electoral work, should be prioritized over any other. While we agree that Medicare for All and labor organizing are good priorities, and that Bernie Sanders offers a way forward for coalition building and improving working people's lives, we also believe that national campaigns and strategies are strongest and most powerful when they are built from the ground up through meaningful participation and experience versus after-the-fact consultation. We believe that locals know best what energizes their members and communities and what needs to happen in them to build socialism. But that depends on where we are right now, which we at Build are trying to figure out by talking with chapters and hearing about their work. By collecting this data and, in the future, setting up model banks for chapters, we can go a long way to improving the foundation that supports campaigns in a myriad of directions, whether they're electoral, direct aid, direct action, anti-fascist, etc. And we think that national should be doing this too. So how should we think about national priorities in our organization when chapter organizing responds to its local context rather than predetermined campaigns? We think that chapters should work with national to democratically develop strategic campaigns, and that the bulk of our resources should be spent there. So at its core, Build is focused on creating organizational structures, processes, and culture that can support a mass movement. Immediately, that means better and more equitable distribution of resources, better processes, and chapter support, as well as more opportunities to learn from our comrades across the country about their projects and get inspired to see what's replicable. Thanks, Micah.
Oh, wow, great. So we can go on then to Renee.
Hi, I'm Renee Parody. I'm a member of the steering committee for the Socialist Majority Caucus. We are the newest caucus, except, I mean, depending on how you count, Momentum 3.0. We're in our first branding. We have over 400 members. Neil and I are friends. I told him I was going to be razzing him on this panel. The way that we developed is basically we have a set of shared principles, and if you believe in the shared principles, you sign on, and then you're a part of the caucus. And that means that we put your name on the website, and we'll let people use first names so that they're not outing themselves as socialists to the whole world, but we do want to have a model of transparency. And once you sign on and go on the website, you're in the caucus and vote on everything that we do. So these shared principles were drafted collectively by a whole bunch of people who were coming together to form the caucus, but they were and then ratified by that group of people, and then people have been signing on since then. But for instance, we're developing a program that's almost ready to be released for sort of what we want to see happen, you know, coming up to this convention. And that's something where, again, everybody in the caucus was, you know, collectively contributed to it. We had an amendment process. As amended, it's going to be hopefully ratified by the whole membership, and then we'll release that. So that's just to say something about sort of how we're running ourselves and how we came together.
You're referring to the national convention this year, right?
Yes, the national. So the reason that we formed this year as opposed to any other year is that the next DSA national convention is coming up this summer, and that's where we elect our national leadership and make any changes that we want to the national structure. So our shared principles are: our urgent task is to build a socialist majority, and that's why we use the name. We understand that there's something almost a little Leninist about calling yourself socialist majority when you're 400 people in a 55,000 organization, but we're referring to the socialist majority we want to build in the world. Organizing working people around immediate and radical demands is our path to power. We're definitely going to, I'm sure, get pilloried as reformists on this panel, much less in the world, but we do believe that demands right now, in the here and now, and working towards those both help build towards a revolutionary moment and train leaders in the movement and improve working people's lives and bring people over to your side. We believe socialists have been most successful when they engage fully with working class struggles in the here and now to win concrete gains, build working class consciousness and militancy, directly confront capitalist economic and political power, and shift the balance of power toward the working class. Effective, well-targeted campaigns around specific demands are at the heart of DSA's political work. We believe in a variety of campaigns, but that every campaign that DSA is doing should have a specific demand, a point where you know whether you've won or lost, and that demand should be, you know, on capitalist power, whether it's landlords, an employer, a legislative body. We distinguish the campaign from other forms of political activity through its discipline and specificity. DSA should embrace a democratic bottom-up model of campaign development that connects local struggles with broader movements. Dismantling racist and oppressive institutions is central to our fight. Socialist feminist praxis informs our organizing and organizational culture. The language I've pulled in from our longer explanation of this is: collective liberation is not only a value but an action. It is the how and what of our work. DSA works most effectively in coalition with organized, progressive, and working class groups. Socialists should engage the labor movement at all levels to build a united, fighting working class movement. I will note, I'm not I don't know all that much about labor, but we are supporting both the rank and file strategy, but also are totally, we have people in union staff. We don't think it's the exclusive route forward for labor strategy, which I think is a distinction with some other folks on panel. DSA can and should be the face of the democratic socialist electoral movement growing across the country. We enthusiastically embrace running candidates on the Democratic line because we think that makes the most sense right now. But what's really important to us is to build an independent structure. And that doesn't have to be a workers' party, and it doesn't have to be a third party. It can be a... it just has to be an independent structure. And so that's part of why we're supporting the Bernie 2020 work that Nationals put forward. And disclosure, I'm on that committee, so if you want to yell about that, know that. And supporting that work in the national electoral strategy that DSA has adopted to make sure that we know how to run an electoral campaign from soup to nuts and can do so outside of the political infrastructure, which I think you've seen here in New York with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Julia Salazar's campaigns we're succeeding at. And we will strive to practice solidarity with each other, even in disagreement, in a way that transforms us as individuals and strengthens us as a collective. We're committed to trying to elevate the discourse to be a little less angry online all the time. I think, a couple of things that I think are also worth talking about. We believe that a strong national organization is important, but we don't believe that national organization should dictate to locals. And so I think, for us, when you look at what has happened in the sort of local national debate, we don't think that it's nefarious. We just think this organization went from a series of book clubs to a mass organization overnight. And our staff and our national leadership are trying to catch up to that. And that a lot of things that get portrayed as national betraying the locals are often very much a part of that infrastructural difficulty. And so one of the things that we're trying to figure out is, like, are there ways to expand the NPC, to expand regional representation that address those without sort of throwing the baby out with the bathwater?
NPC, the National Elected Body, right? Important
yes, to say, sorry. Yeah. The National Political Committee, which is the basically the board of DSA. And I will yield my remaining 15 seconds.
Great. Thank you. Neil.
Great. So I want to take up 3 points today. First, I want to try to put DSA's political strategy into a bigger picture. I think it can be really exciting to, and it's really important to talk about electoral tactics, organizational matters, but I think sometimes if we don't start with the bigger picture, we lose sight of what we're doing. And I know, especially for like an international audience, which we have today, it's important to kind of give kind of an understanding of where DSA is at. So I'll start there, and then I'll present a little bit about what I think are the immediate tasks for the organization in the next year or so. And I'll close out by saying a few things about what I think our organizational priorities as DSA are. As Micah mentioned, I'm a member of the Bread and Roses Caucus. I'm editor for The Call. I think my views generally align with the views of members of my caucus, but just like all my other panelists, I wouldn't want to try to hold them responsible for everything I say. So take this as my view that others in our caucus may or may not agree with. So to start, I think our primary mission as socialists, as I see it, is to help unlock the power of the working class in the United States. And our goal is really to fuse a reborn and mighty workers' movement, one that through the power of strikes, mobilizations, and elections can challenge and ultimately defeat the capitalist class. Our goal is to fuse that movement with the much smaller but no less important socialist movement. And that raises the question of what we as socialists can do to bring this merger about. What actions can we take to rebuild the power of the working class and connect it to the socialist movement? We know to begin that left-wing, democratic, and militant labor organizing in the workplace is one of the primary means by which the latent power of the working class can be realized. And so in DSA, the work of building dissident rank-and-file caucuses is a really important part of our project. In New York City, for example, our members are actively involved in unions for teachers, nurses, carpenters, communication workers, public sector workers. But we also believe that the power of the working class needs to be expressed not only in the workplace, but also at the ballot box. We think that the state acts as a really important partner and support for the capitalist class, and that challenging capitalists also means challenging them and their supporters and representatives in elections, in city halls, in Congress, and in state legislatures. And to do so most effectively, we need our own political party. We need a party of the working class. One that, and I'd really be curious to hear what others on this panel think about this, one that I think will likely emerge through some sort of left-wing split from the Democratic Party in the future. And I think that has to be kind of our guiding star as a political project. And you know, that might come about through a dirty break. We can talk about the particular details of that. But alone, these elements aren't enough. We also need ideas, a vision, and a plan as well. And that's where socialist organizers can be very helpful. We study the history and workings of organizations and movements that have challenged capitalism, not because we're curious or because we're working out some sort of academic puzzle, but because we're trying to constantly refine and develop a plan for challenging capitalism as a system. We're trying to develop a program, one that speaks to the material needs of the working class, one that is popular and feasible, but also that pushes the envelope, that leads to greater and greater incursions on the rights of capitalists. And in the words of UK Labour Party's John McDonnell, we want the cumulative effect of these reforms to create an irreversible shift in wealth and power in favor of working people. And it also has to be a program that challenges the very real oppressions that working class people feel every day, whether those are racial, national, gender, or sexual oppression, among others. So only by putting these elements together into a full program can we have a real socialist strategy, one truly inspired by the old Labour slogan that an injury to one is an injury to all. When we fuse these two elements, a working class movement on the one hand, built around powerful worker-run unions and its own party with a socialist program, with a vision for transforming society, I think we'll have the basic ingredients that working class people need to change the world and make it better. Obviously, though, as DSA activists and as socialist activists, we need much more than a big picture. We also need a strong understanding of what our tasks today are. And these tasks, and they include raising demands, building campaigns, organizing, are really the critical kind of near-term component which turns this big vision into something that's actually making progress and building towards something in the here and now. I think actually today, and I think this came out in our panel already, DSA's tasks are pretty clear. From Bernie 2020 to supporting insurgent teachers, from preparing for mobilizations against police violence and attacks on women's rights, to raising key demands like Medicare for All and a Green New Deal, I think it's DSA's duty to fight alongside all working people to win immediate victories and fight for not so immediate structural reforms and to build power through strong grassroots movement organizations. And I'd be happy to talk more about these tasks in the Q&A or in our discussion. I think there's a lot we can get into there, but I'll just kind of leave that there for now because I think there might not be a whole lot of disagreement on those very specific tasks. Finally, I want to talk about our organizational priorities. In DSA, we're still figuring out the right balance between the Big Tent organization and the caucuses, between national and local, between working groups and branches. We are a 60,000 member organization that has let a million flowers bloom in terms of organizational forms. And that's, I think, actually a really good thing. But I'm going to leave that to the side and just kind of focus on what I think the three organizational tasks for DSA as a whole are. First, I think in the period in which we're organizing, in which kind of a new generation of activists is coming to life after what will hopefully be the nadir of the socialist movement in the 1990s and 2000s, not to be confused with Ralph Nader, although oddly very similar names. I think we have to be constantly raising key socialist demands and agitating around them so that they become kind of the common sense of our period. We need to help people move from resignation to action by connecting the big picture, the fight to win a socialist future, to immediate problems and convincing people that we really can win when we organize. We have to be what Tony Gramsci once called on socialist organizers to be, which is to be permanent persuaders, fighters whose main task is to raise awareness of what is to be done among the working class. Second, it's our job as activists in DSA to train cadre. Cadre are the organizers who form the backbone of the socialist movement, who, as the saying goes, can be dropped into a new city and build the foundations of a socialist organization within only a couple months. Who see the big picture and can figure out what the immediate organizing tasks are. And finally, as an organization, we have to get better at concentrating our resources. We have a limited supply of volunteer time and financial resources. We need to be able to concentrate them on the most pressing campaigns at the moment. So I'll close out there. I mean, I think it's been a sometimes bumpy, usually entertaining, I think always inspiring ride with DSA so far. We've got a lot to be proud of. It's incredible to see in the heart of imperialism this thing which people thought wasn't possible, a mini mass socialist movement start to emerge. And we've got a long way to go and a lot of things to think through. But I'm really excited about where we're at, and I'm really excited to talk to you all about what DSA is all about.
North, I can't represent North Star. Mostly North Star, I think, most of the members are people who actually were DSA members before the membership bump. And to a certain extent, their view reflects the more Michael Harrington tradition of DSA, which doesn't appear too strongly in the current discourse inside DSA, but it's still lurking in the ranks. And that's one thing that North Star represents. But I think another thing that's more important is what was not mentioned by any of the panelists, which is the fact that we are living in a country where the far right is part of the regime and the left is barely present. Our presence is growing, but at this point it's just a Democratic Party that you could call a center-left alliance. And then on the other wings of government, there are far rightists sitting at every table. So the question is, what's our relationship to Trump and the 2020 elections in general? What if Trump gains more popularity? What if the Democrats completely blow it? What role do we have to play in all of that? That's much more immediate politically than the question of how can we turn DSA into something that we would prefer it to be. And this is, I'm not explicating as well as Miriam could, and I'm really sorry she's not here, but I would have some other things to say about all this stuff, not as a North Star person in the discussion, but I hope that sort of clarifies where we're at.
Thank you.
May I add if you will?
He's in North Star.
Yeah, very briefly.
Okay. Membership of North Star overlaps to a large extent with membership of Socialist Majority. We were formed before Socialist Majority emerged, and we were really not the other caucuses. So we were the alternative to them. But then Socialist Majority emerged, there exists a lot of overlap. Currently, North Star is in the process of rewriting its statement of principles, on which we are going to vote very soon.
Miriam just walked in.
And it's coming up with three priorities for the organization. Electoral, which means really dealing with the threat of Trumpism. Uh-huh. And I want to finish the Green New Deal and immigration. We're in the process of voting on those three priorities at the moment.
Great. Hi, Miriam. You're
very late.
You have
there she is.
You just got an explication of your caucus. You have 3.5 minutes, but yeah, we covered a bunch of ground about the centrality of defeating Trump. The caucus is being part of the sort of Michael Harrington tradition of the organization pre-explosion in 2016. Anything you want to overlap with Socialist Majority as well? Anything you want to add to that in 3 minutes?
First of all, I want to apologize for everybody that I underestimated the MPA's capacity. And I particularly am sad that I'm late because I really wanted to hear, in particular, the Libertarian, Socialist, and Bill presentations, since I don't know their perspective well. And I really believe that it's important for a healthy organization to have good discussions between caucuses so we understand each other's points of view and we can have perhaps passionate but also respectful exchange of ideas about which way we go. And I think that the organization has been having a lot of unhealthy discussions, which have been more like power struggles and not good debates about it. I think that, so I joined, I was a founding member of the North Star Caucus about a year ago, out of concern for that, and out of also concern that I get that, and I think most of us felt that the Democratic part of the Democratic Socialist tradition was being dropped by some members who were being very outspoken, and that concerned me because I think that it is of the essence of any socialism I want to be part of, that the democracy in government is central to what socialism should be, but expanded to the economic realm. And also that our own organization should have a good democratic internal life.
1 minute.
I think the priorities that North Star has adopted for the convention, fighting Trumpism and its barefaced racism and hatefulness, is essential in the abstract and at this political moment in particular, and that the Green New Deal has become a matter of incredible urgency, and has all the people that we, people are in motion, so we have to be there with them, and that the fight to protect immigrants and refugees is also urgent at this motion, deeply part of our values and essential. And I think that the national organization should be providing a lot of resources to help the locals do that effectively. And I had one other thing I was going to say, but maybe I'll bring it up in questions.
Great.
I apologize again.
All right, no problem. Great, so obviously DSA is a multi-tendency organization, and you just heard an articulation of many tendencies reflective of that multi-tendency nature. Let's start for the discussions in the panel just with the more basic question, not about any of the specific political priorities that anyone raised, but the basic question of why have internal formations in a organization like DSA at all. I know people who come from a wide variety of political backgrounds or have a wide variety of political beliefs, but see the emergence of caucuses in the organization as not a healthy thing in its current life, given that the organization, you know, just sort of exploded, became this new organization after Trump's election, and there's a worry that I've heard articulated from some people that the openness of DSA and the fact that you don't have to adhere to any one kind of specific socialist ideology within the broad tent of socialism is a strength, and that caucuses can actually drive people away, and as well as, of course, leading to like factional warfare and then sort of a hunkering down of people within their own faction. So can we hear, and from anybody who wants to answer that question, what is your response to that charge? Having considered such a thing, why do you think it's important to put forward a caucus anyway? Yeah, sure, John.
Unless somebody else wants to speak.
Go ahead, yeah.
I have very strong opinions about this because I'm actually at work on a pamphlet called The Case for Caucuses. So, and the gist of it is this, and this is my personal opinion, but there are, I think, general consensus with LSC ideas based on things that we've written collectively before. When the stakes are high in any decision that has to be made, there are going to be disagreements. It's just a fact. Like, if you're affected by a decision, and it's going to affect a lot of people, people have different temperaments, different priorities, whatever, and there's going to be different points of view on the subject. You cannot have democracy without pluralism. You cannot have a real democracy unless people are able to organize for their point of view in order to be able to present it forward and convince other people through civil debate and rational debate that this is actually like the way that we should do things. And then whatever democratic process exists for making the decision, after everybody's been heard out, people decide to go one way or the other, or usually with some kind of compromise. But the problem is that if there's just because there's going to be disagreement doesn't mean that that disagreement gets adjudicated through a nice little deliberative process like what I was just describing. Instead, what might happen is that a group of people who are just informally friends may have a particular point of view, but they don't admit that they exist. They just kind of hang out in their private like parties or in their like, you know, back rooms, and they already decide that this is how they're going to do things. And because they don't actively put forward a position that people can like, you know, disagree with, but instead just organize to stuff various committees with like-minded people, and those committees have all the decision-making power, and therefore people have to go along with their decision without a debate, or even the acknowledgement that there was organizing going on in order to make it happen, that is a good way that a supposedly democratic organization can actually become dictatorial. This is what the anarcho-feminist theorist Joe Freeman famously called the tyranny of structurelessness. And ironically, although it is often interpreted as an attack on the principle of horizontalism, in other words, bottom-up council decision-making, it's actually an attack upon like this kind of like informal grouping that oftentimes are the people, I would argue, who are making that argument against Bella Sears, who are very influenced by Joe Freeman's ideas. So in short, there should be caucuses, because there should be the open and transparent articulation of views with which people can agree or disagree, rather than shadowy cliques operating in back rooms informally.
Great. So, and I should explain, I'm going to do, in the interest of time management, 2 minutes for each response, and I'll say 2 to 3 people can respond to each question so we can get through more questions. Renee, you had a response.
So, Socialist Majority says we're a non-ideological caucus, right? Like, we're not demanding a particular a line other than the shared principles, which I forgot to say in my thing and thought this is an appropriate time to say it. But I think, right, like, the emergence of caucuses is something that happens in response to the democratic structure, right? We have a national election for 16 people in an organization of 50,000 people. How do you possibly organize around that without forming something akin to political parties, right? Like they formed in every democracy ever. That's, I think, what caucuses are on some level. And so for me, particularly with Socialist Majority, because we're non-ideological, it is a very much sort of a coalition that we're forming to try and say, here's the kinds of things that we want to see happen in national leadership, and that's why we're organizing in this way. And again, like the convention was the spur for us to organize, and like it's a very specific contingent thing. So I think when people say, oh, we shouldn't have caucuses, then we need to figure out a way. If you really want that, you have to change the structure of DSA fundamentally. I think for me, as we'll get into, I'm sure when we talk about electoral politics, you know, particularly as Marxists, we should understand that like the structure is going to create what happens. And so if you have a set of rules that says that is electoral rules that lends itself to the creation of parties, you are going to end up with caucuses.
Neil?
Yes, I really agree with what Renee and John are saying. I mean, I think that it would be very hard to structure debates and elections in the organization in a really large organization without something akin to political parties, as Renee is saying. So I think that's like, it's kind of a natural outgrowth of the structure of the organization. We're not a top-down kind of Leninist type of organization. We are really sometimes chaotic, but very democratic body, and I think that's one of the best things about DSA. I think that, and it's also worth noting that there's no, as far as I can tell, I've thought about this a little bit, there's no mass like left party or organization in the world that I know of that's democratic that doesn't have something resembling tendencies or caucuses within it. And you know, the mass parties of the left that have refused to have caucuses tend to have been the most authoritarian in their structure. Or tendencies, whatever you want to call it. I think actually caucuses play another role, though, and you know, something that we're trying to do with Bread and Roses, which is that DSA is, to its benefit, really a giant big tent organization with, you know, people from, well, Miriam, you confuse the left to right spectrum. I'm just kidding. But, you know, we got our far left on the, John Michael, to me and Renee and Miriam somewhere in the mushy center right of DSA. Just kidding, I'm on the center left. One of the important things that what caucuses can do is that they can provide a political home to organizers so that, you know, DSA is really important to be doing organizing in DSA. We view DSA as the most important vehicle for our politics. But, you know, in terms of your political education, your training as an organizer, it is also helpful to have a group of people who share some certain basic foundational assumptions with you that form the basis of kind of a political education or political training. So I think that's another role that caucuses potentially can play in the future. It's something that we're trying to use Bread and Roses as a kind of an experiment to see if that works.
All right, I'm going to break my own rule and let everybody respond to this question because it's a sort of basic, important question. And maybe, Tawny, if you could articulate, I mean, your organization, your formation is not a caucus explicitly.
Right, yeah.
Can you talk about why you think it's important to not be a caucus?
So we're not a caucus because BILD is actually made up of people from many of the caucuses in DSA. So we don't have a strong political line in that sense. We kind of think it's, with like respect to like, I agree with caucusing, I think it's great. But BILD kind of feels like we are, like the caucusing is like a step four activity and that we are worried about the step one activity of making sure that there is a solid foundation of processes, ways to plug members into campaigns, ways to address harassment within the organization, like basic building block things that keep people organizing with DSA before we get to whether or not someone leans in a particular direction. So we have people from the LSC, we have people from the Socialist Majority, there's an unrepresented caucus that came up recently called, they're different sort of CPN. I don't know what it stands for. Collective Power Network. I was like, it's not communist. so we have a bunch of different people, and we are primarily concerned with basically like providing a way for people to connect with each other over whether or not someone shares a particular set of politics, as long as they agree with our big tent values.
Great. And Miriam, you wanted to say something on this?
So first, I've actually agreed with all of you to a large extent. And I'm just going to prepare to say everything that John Michael said. Jo Freeman is a very old friend of mine. I think she was a member of DSOC before DSA was formed. And the only thing I would say is that I think when she wrote that, it was in response to the supposed consensus orientation of the women's movement, which didn't even have voting at all. I think that the important difference is that a caucus is openly organizing and appeals to everybody, and people can join, and it's not a nasty power struggle. Of course, there's an element of your friends and my friends. When I joined Socialist Majority, it was partly because my best, closest, most trusted friends were in there, people I've known for 30 and 40 years. I spent the last 2 years doing a lot in New York DSA, and I'm very close to and deeply admire a lot of the people in Socialist Majority. And I, with the little exposure I've had to the other groups, I've discovered I like a lot of their ideas, and there are a lot of overlaps. One of the things I would note is that a lot of the people that were in the North Star group now were in opposed factions in the past, and I expect that some of us right now are in different groups and will be in the same. We'll be in alliance now against something else, and maybe we'll be in the same group in the future, and that's one will help you.
Great. So lots of agreement so far. Everybody likes everything everybody's doing. Let's talk about a question that maybe will spark some disagreement. I think everyone probably agrees that the Bernie Sanders 2020 campaign is going to be central to probably in some ways, in one way or another, to DSA over the next year and a half, as well as to the nation as a whole. So what are the sort of differing approaches to the thoughts on how DSA should approach the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2020? I'll take two or three people talking about this.
Okay. Reform. So the DSA has endorsed Bernie Sanders, and the national plan is to do an independent expenditure for complicated campaign finance reasons. There's been a lot of both concern over whether or not we should have endorsed and concern over whether or not that's the framework that the campaign should take. For us, the independent expenditure is really important because it means that DSA can run its own canvases, can print its own literature, can have its own website, can have its own messaging, all the things that we do to build a separate electoral infrastructure apart from a particular candidate or the Democratic Party. We believe that the independent expenditure proposed by the committee is the only way to do that. We don't think anybody should ever be forced to do Bernie work, like both on the chapter level and amongst chapters. But we think it's going to be the biggest sort of mass movement of people on the left over the course of the next year. And it would be irresponsible, frankly, of DSA to like not try and take people who are going to be motivated by that and move them into the socialist movement.
Great. Yeah, Miriam?
So, I agree with it, and I have a quibble. And my quibble is that I think that sometimes when we organize separately, we don't meet enough our allies, and then we don't build the relationships strongly enough.
You're referring to the independent expenditure part of
it. Well, I don't mind the independent expenditure. It's that if we're using it to organize our people separately from our allies in this fight, we won't create the bonds with them enough. It's still possible. We organized separately for Ocasio-Cortez, and we connected with her, and we ended up meeting them a lot and recruiting a lot of them through direct contact as well as her TV appearances. But I just worry about sometimes the separate movement part having unintended consequences, and also I think a lot of our small locals should be DSA members operating in our revolution or whatever.
Great. Neil?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most remarkable things that's happened in the last few years is that in the U.S., there's been this kind of electoral revolt that's channeling a lot of energy and excitement for kind of progressive ideas, for even socialist ideas, into kind of a mass movement. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people on the socialist left in the past who've been very dismissive of electoral work. And I think that the last few years proves the critical importance of contesting elections as democratic socialists and the role that can play in building a kind of mass movement. And I just think that the facts are indisputable about that at this point. So I think Bernie is the next frontier in this battle in cohering this kind of electoral revolt that's going on in the country. I think it's having an amazing impact on the level of class consciousness in the United States too. Bernie is spreading demands like the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, ending mass incarceration, ending foreign interventions. These are demands that people now relate to on a very profound level and really see as like connected to each other and want to be part of building this campaign. And I think it's incredible. And we see the positive feedback loop too between electoral work and bottom-up organizing. I mean, West Virginia is the perfect example of this. We had in West Virginia a number of teachers who joined DSA, who came out of the Bernie campaign, who were energized by Bernie, who then decided after the campaign was over, we got to figure out how to transform our union, how to transform this state. And they started organizing in their state to build a wildcat strike, to build a rank and file strike. And it's incredible that this feedback loop that really does exist. I think I generally agree with, I think Renee and I are pretty much on the same page about what kind of campaign that DSA should run. We want to have an independent campaign, both for matters of campaign finance, but also because it helps us build our structure, our infrastructure as an organization. And, you know, we might disagree on the long-term purpose of it. For Renee, I think Renee correctly sees the importance of an independent structure as what will guarantee our kind of like principled independence from the Democratic Party. For me, in addition to that, I think there's an element of it being the basis for the formation of a new Workers' Party in the future. But I definitely think it's really important to have an independent structure while being non-sectarian towards the Bernie campaign and working with the Bernie campaign. But I'll stop there.
Well, this is the next question I was going to ask, actually, which was about the orientation towards the Democratic Party. This has been brought up a few times in people's opening remarks. But, you know, this is a perpetual question on the left in America, the proper orientation towards the Democrats. Do folks have explications of that? John? Yeah.
Well, Mike, not to break your rule, but given the allegedly anti-electoralist position, could I?
Sure.
The Democratic question?
Go ahead.
There's overlap. So the problem with the Bernie endorsement, to kind of insert some disagreement, was not the endorsement in and of itself. Not so much anyway, so much as the process by which it was undertaken. And this is a good example of the kind of tensions that actually exist within DSA. There's split opinions within LSC about electoralism, like I said, or whether or not and to what extent to support Bernie. But what we were in consensus about, which we were able to put out a large statement about, was the idea that the Bernie process was rushed, top-down, and too much at the discretion of informal groups within the National Political Committee rather than any kind of transparent and formalized and joinable group that could have put forward the proposal, including the independent expenditure campaign. And this is one instance among many of this kind of thing. National working groups have a general problem, which is that it's very difficult to get on them unless you know somebody on the MPC. And even though there's an email address that you can do, it's at their discretion whether they answer, and oftentimes if you don't know somebody, it's messy. And then on top of that, it was not the National Electoral Working Group that had previously existed that did this proposal, but another group that did it that was itself people who oftentimes knew each other and, you know, that kind of thing. Then when the proposal was put forward, like, the process ended for the endorsement before the last in-person meeting of DSA groups for the pre-convention was able to meet, like, so there wasn't as much discussion as there could have been. And a lot of people, including, I forget how many chapters, maybe you know, it was like 20 chapters, I think, right? Somebody should know this, but came out with statements saying that the decision should be delayed until the convention, because there's no rush. But instead, the MPC put forward a referendum, and obviously the Bernie position did win, although not by a supermajority, interestingly.
75%.
Oh, yeah.
74. 76, okay. But.
10 seconds.
Could you just clarify, the referendum went out to all the members?
Yes.
Of the
yes, which I would, to be, and on a constructive note, in my personal opinion as an individual, the one good thing that came out of this was the precedent of a referendum, which is an important reform that LSC actually wants to put forward. But if somebody wants to ask me in the Q&A what was wrong with the referendum, that's a good way of talking about it.
The chair rules no feeding the audience questions. And I would, you brought up a bunch of important stuff there, but I would just remember that not everybody in the audience is in DSA and familiar with DSA, so we're going to focus on the sort of big picture strategic and questions for DSA. Yeah, Renee?
So I am on that committee, the one that put forward that thing. I was not put on that committee because I know people. I was put on that committee because I was the co-chair of the NEC. I was the co-chair of the NEC because I was elected by all of the electoral working groups in the country who got to vote to put people on that National Electoral Committee. And then I was put on the Bernie Committee, at which point we said, okay, because of compliance, because of developing field work, because of the incredible undertaking that a presidential campaign is, we don't believe it's feasible to wait until August. And we put together that proposal. And then the NPC voted on that proposal and accepted that proposal. Now, if you don't believe that the NPC should vote on something, that's fine and good, but I'm really sorry, the National Political Committee, it's the board we were talking about. But I just
not to cut you off, I just wanted to make sure we are focused on the bigger picture questions, like the one I asked about the
I mean, he went over time like maligning me,
yeah,
so
no, it's fair that she should, because that's a direct response.
Yeah, go ahead, finish up then.
This is the first time that all of DSA's membership was polled. All of the chapters were told to discuss it within their chapters. Many chapters, including New York, passed things supporting the Bernie endorsement. It wasn't an ideal process. It's not the process that if I had infinite time and infinite resources, I would do. But I think this is exactly the kind of thing where we get so caught up in the process that the actual thing we're talking about gets lost, and people end up characterizing their political opponents as being part of a shadowy cabal. And like, I'm not part of a shadowy cabal, I'm a nationally elected official in DSA. Sorry, but yeah. No, that's...
no. So which question?
I'm gonna go on to the substance.
Okay, well, yeah, the bigger
so,
question,
first,
yes.
Also, the process we use, was based on one that we used in New York about the Cynthia Nixon and Monty Williams one, which Renee helped build, and which was it was good. And I'm also in favor of having at least some national referendums, just and having more local ones as well. Look, I don't like the Democratic Party. I never have, okay? And I've spent when I've been active, I took a big break to have children while working full times. When I've been politically engaged for 25 or something of the last 40 years, it's been mostly through the Democratic Party, because the structure of politics, our electoral system, nationally and in most but not all local jurisdictions means that that's where things are happening. And if you want to have an impact, to get attention and get your ideas out, and if you actually want to win and change things to make life better, that's what you have to do. Now, why do I not like it? I don't like it because there are all kinds of horrible imperialists in it. I don't like it because of all this neoliberal crap, which, you know, I've been like fighting that Clintonism stuff since college, and I'm 60 years old now.
I don't like it because the way, like the Queen's democratic machine and the work, I hate them. One of the things I loved about electing Alexandria, helping to elect, was that she helped to destroy, she's getting our ideas out, she's doing a wonderful thing nationally, she gave us all those members, and she, her election dealt a body blow to the Queen's machine, and if we elect Tiffany Caban, district attorney in Queens, I don't think they're gonna survive. And that would be fabulous.
So that's kind of, yeah. All right, Neil?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that in DSA, there's general consensus around the need to be flexible on the use of the Democratic Party ballot line. It's just a recognition of the real complexities and difficulties of U.S. electoral law, that it's very hard to establish a third party that's going to be able to make any sort of gains in the U.S. just from scratch. You can't just declare a third party. We've seen plenty of experiments and experiences with that have failed. So I think it's a reality that we just have to confront. If we want to do electoral work effectively, if we want to elect some people in the near future who can be tribunes for our movement, who can, you know, advance democratic socialist politics, who can give people a sense that we really can win and lay the groundwork for something bigger and better, I think it, you know, in many cases it's going to have to be through, you know, on the Democratic Party ballot line, contesting primaries. And that's just a reality. And we can talk more about this in the Q&A. I'd love to talk about the details of it, but I think that's something that we kind of all accept. I think there is some disagreement about whether or not what comes next, you know, what comes in the future, what are we orienting to? And I do think it's actually an important question, because if you don't have an orientation, if you don't know, like, what are you striving for, I think it's easy to kind of just continue to do this Democratic Party ballot line thing forever and not contend with some really important questions. I think the Democratic Party really does exist. Like, there are tens of thousands of party officials, elected politicians who are Democrats. There's an apparatus that's not democratic that exists up in the ether that is run by consultants and NGOs and different party bodies that have no accountability that really does decide policy for the party as a whole. And the reality is that whether we think, you know, we have an understanding in DSA of the need to use the Democratic Party tactically as DSA. But for most people, they just see DSA candidates as Democrats. And so if we want to build consciousness through our electoral work, we've got to think about an independent ballot line in the future. I think that's kind of an absolutely necessary part of our project, something we have to be building towards. So in DSA, I think there's a consensus about the need for ballot line flexibility, but we have a kind of a debate about whether or not we're going to need what we call a dirty break in the future, some sort of left-wing split from the Democratic Party in order to achieve or build an independent ballot line.
Yeah, last on this, Tani.
I would just stress that we also need to look, like, I have no problem personally with the Democratic ballot line. Like, I'm not a huge electoralist. I've done, like, a little bit of work here and there, but I think we need to think more broadly about electoral work. Like, according to the report that we did as, like, a brief survey of chapters, people are doing significantly more, like, ballot initiative work in the electoral arena than they are running candidates. And I think that that is maybe a little bit different way to think about using the electorate. But I also think that we need to go beyond the electorate and think about building a broader movement to support electoral work when and if we get the opportunity to do something like the Ocasio-Cortez campaign. If you have a broader base of people who are, you know, organized into tenants unions, organized at their workplaces, those people can be activated much more easily than doing some like activist network stuff, knocking on doors when you have a candidate but not really talking to people otherwise, things like that. And I'm not accusing anyone on this panel of doing that, but I'm just saying as a broad strategy, I think that we need to think a little bit broader than candidates as an organization.